this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
Today, we'll discuss the effectiveness of protective equipment for federal correctional officers with AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Brian Lowry, Japan's recovery efforts with AFGE contract analyst Tim Shirock, and the Affordable Care Act with SEIU Healthcare Chair Dr. Tony Lewis. Brian Lowry, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jason.
The Government Accountability Office released a report on whether protective equipment would enhance correctional officer safety in the Bureau of Prisons. What did the study find?
Well, the study found a number of factors here, Jason. First of all, the report was actually done to evaluate the impact of protective equipment that could enhance officer safety. In this report, GAO found several factors here. Number one, that the BOP, Bureau of Prisons, has not evaluated the effectiveness of the equipment it provides to ensure an officer safety, and that correctional equipment experts report that the Bureau of Prisons needs to consider a variety of factors in the acquisition and decisions they make to provide additional equipment. Now, currently, Bureau of Prisons officers are unarmed when they're working inside of these prisons. The only protective equipment that they actually carry on them is actually a radio with a body alarm feature on it in case the officer needs assistance or there's a situation, disturbance, assault on staff or on inmates.
And you mentioned that the Bureau of Prisons hasn't evaluated some of these protective measures yet. Is that right?
Well, they have not evaluated the effectiveness of any additional equipment. In this report, it was also found that the Bureau of Prisons and along with the union and the staff believe that communication is probably the most essential skill that a correctional professional actually can use in most situations. And we agree with that factor. However, the Bureau of Prisons believes if they were to issue things in open compound settings, such as pepper spray to staff members, that staff would less likely use their skills to communicate with inmates in these situations and rely more heavily upon the equipment.
Do you agree with that assessment?
I do not agree with that assessment. We are a very, very well-trained organization. Our staff members actually are very professional and conduct themselves in a professional manner. However, since 2000 to 2010, this study also says that the inmate population has actually grown 50% in that time frame, which we haven't brought that many prisons online in order to safely run and operate our prisons. Overcrowding in our prisons creates undue tension and stress on the inmates, and it also harms or hurts our abilities to safely manage and supervise these inmates as well. So with that factor alone, it has increased the violence that has continued to escalate year to year to year. And some violent acts have actually become more serious, where staff have been injured, and even in some instances, some of our staff members were murdered. And the last was being Jose Rivera on June 20th, 2008 at Atwater.
Brian, that the Bureau relies heavily on the communication skills of its correctional officers, yet the populations in the prisons are rising, inmates are more aggressive, staffing levels appear to be down on correctional officers. At some point, does communication skills become outweighed by other factors mentioned before, such as overcrowding and a more aggressive inmate population?
Well, the Bureau of Prisons, in the union's opinion, has a vicarious liability to ensure safe and orderly operations of its facilities, to protect its staff who work in the prisons, and also at the same time to ensure that we look out for the best interests of the inmates and to protect them as well. since violence has escalated and serious incidents have continued to be a large factor of what's currently happening in the prison system, we believe additional equipment is necessary, because a lot of incidents that do occur in our prisons actually happen instantaneously, the heat of the moment. There are no warning signs. There are preventive measures, such as if a disturbance kicks off in the institution, a rioting-type situation, to where we do have the necessary equipment to go respond and quell that disturbance. But in many cases, the assaults that are occurring are like instantaneous events, and the officers have nothing other than that body alarm radio, or to try to defend that inmate with their hands, and no other equipment to try to detain them until other responders come in and assist those individual staff members.
So this really becomes a safety issue, right, Brian?
It is a safety issue, Jason. And, you know, at the end of this report, and it's like a 70-page report, and it's fairly lengthy, and there are a lot of graphs and charts in here that talk about overcrowding, that talk about understaffing, that the ratio since 2000 to 2010, since our population has grown by 50%, there are now less staff to manage and supervise these institutions than there were 11 years ago.
So let's talk about some specifics for a second. If an officer is in a dangerous situation, and right now he or she is only armed with a radio and a body alarm, how would something like pepper spray or additional protective equipment really neutralize the situation and give the correctional officer an opportunity to fight back just in terms of protection until further help arrives?
Well, the additional equipment is one of those preventative measures that we believe that actually would work in most situations that we encounter. Now, there may be some situations to where, you know, that the equipment, the additional equipment that they provide the staff, or something such as pepper spray or batons or even tasers in some sense, if they were issued to staff, in all cases might not work in that situation. However, we believe when an inmate decides to attack a staff member with or without a weapon, that staff have to have the ability to be able to fend that inmate off, hit their body alarm, to alert staff, to respond to that area. And until additional staff get there, it could be more than one inmate attacking a staff member, that at least that staff member has some defense mechanism to prevent serious bodily injury or even death to themselves. And in other situations, to where there are inmates assaulting other inmates with weapons, that staff would have the ability then to try to contain the situation instantaneously until other staff arrive. And that is the importance of trying to get additional equipment such as pepper spray issued to staff, so that they have the ability to instantaneously respond to try to prevent these things and serious injury.
Brian, you mentioned before the tragic death of Jose Rivera, who is a correctional officer at the USP in Atwater. How would additional protective equipment maybe impacted the outcome of that situation?
Well, in the situation that involved the death of Jose Rivera, there were cameras in the unit, and there is videotape that actually shows it was a two-tier unit, which means there was two levels, and Jose Rivera actually happened to be on the top level, and the cameras actually identify the fact that when two inmates began attacking Officer Rivera, he was able to break away from them and get to the stairwell to go down. He separated himself. The inmates continued to pursue him, caught up with him on the stairwell. He was able to separate himself again and get on the ground floor before they tackled and brutally stabbed and murdered Officer Rivera. The thing is we believe if Officer Rivera would have had the ability to have some pepper spray that he could have carried, he would have been able then, when he separated himself, to be able to use that and to give him an opportunity to at least stun the inmates. He had activated his body alarm radio at that time, but it took responding staff a couple of minutes to get over to the area, get the doors unlocked, and come inside and to try to restrain those inmates. And we believe there was enough time for Officer Rivera during the times he had separated himself to at least have that piece of equipment to give him the ability to prevent the incident which occurred that led to his death.
And Brian, so that we're clear and the audience understands, you're advocating for non-lethal munitions for correctional officers, such as pepper spray, batons, maybe a taser, nothing like loaded weapons or anything like that, correct?
Absolutely not any loaded weapons. Less lethal equipment, such as pepper spray, which is more or less the preference. And if you look at this study as well, 9 out of the 14 largest state systems around the country actually authorize their staff to carry pepper spray. And this stuff, being less lethal, has no long-term effects on anybody it's used against. It's just a short-term effect to be able to stun and detain that inmate from resisting for several minutes, and that would give us the ability, once a staff does call for assistance and hit their body alarm radio, that in that time may prevent further aggression from the individual.
Brian, in the report, GAO compared federal correctional officers to state correctional officers. Can you share some of the details in the report and the comparisons between the two?
Well, the comparisons between the two, state and federal, we operate different types of systems between all of them. And I would say the variance, even on the state corrections outfits, there are rules and regulation differences in some of these incidents. However, with most of these, and you've got to go by security levels of institutions. We have various security levels in our prisons. But in most of these instances, the additional equipment given, in some instances, staff may carry pepper spray, and some they may carry batons on them. In some, where they may not carry pepper spray or batons or tasers or anything like that, then they have used things such as having two officers together at all times, two or more, so that staff can protect themselves and have somebody there to respond should a situation occur. Now, in many instances, although there may be, 300, 350 staff members that work at any given institution in the Bureau, and all staff are considered when the ratios are actually calculated, in many instances, our staff work these housing units somewhere between 150 and, in some cases, at some low security level prisons, up to 350 inmates by themselves, with no additional staff member assigned to them, and that's who they're supervising. Now, there may be many staff, especially during the hours of day watch, somewhere between 6 a.m. and 6 p.m., you may have anywhere in the middle of that 250 staff on duty. However, that officer in that unit is still by himself, for the most part, supervising those inmates in those units. And the numbers even drop further of how many staff are actually available to respond or be there after the hours of 4 o'clock, and then you have a very reduced staff from midnight to about 6 a.m. before staff come back in that morning, starting to report.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next we'll continue with AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Brian Lowry about the issues facing the Bureau of Prisons.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. Call the AFGE Benefits line at 1-888-844-2343 today to see how much you could save. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're joined by Brian Lowry, president of AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. Brian, previously we were talking about the GAO report on the enhancement of officer safety if they were given some protective equipment. Based on the GAO's assessment of the situation, what do you expect to see next from the Bureau of Prisons?
Well, as I stated early on, the Bureau of Prisons in the report, the GAO found that they have not evaluated the effectiveness of equipment it provides to ensuring officer safety. And with that said, they have not done any additional studies or surveys. Now, since Jose Rivera was murdered in June of 2008, the union has actually pursued and actually participated in labor management relations meetings and tried to get the agency to consider alternatives and to consider additional equipment such as pepper spray issue and to bring it in slowly to start at high security level prisons as well as administrative detention centers where you have inmates doing more time and have committed more violent crimes in which they're incarcerated. And the recommendation from the GAO to the Bureau of Prisons was actually for the Bureau to start capitalizing on some of the data that it already collects and to work with and institute some expertise from the National Institute of Justice and the National Institute of Corrections. And the Bureau of Prisons actually responded to this report on April 5th, 2011, and the Bureau actually stated that they concur with the recommendations from the GAO and with the assistance of NIJ, which is National Institute of Justice, and NIC, the National Institute of Corrections, that they will start conducting a study to evaluate the impact of protective equipment on officer safety. Now, at the end of this, on their response, I believe this is just a fluff response. Although they do collect data on assaults and overcrowding and the number of inmates and on understaffing needs in the prisons, I believe that was a way for them just to say, okay, we'll look at these things, but that they don't intend on trying to start this evaluation in any sense. As a matter of fact, we are getting ready to put in a request to the agency to find out, based on their response to GAO, as to when they're going to start evaluating and ask that they be transparent when they do this in order to see what the outcome of their report is, which actually has no closure date. So I don't think that they're putting emphasis on starting this, in my opinion.
Will you be trying to push them in that direction to make some changes on this?
I absolutely will, and the union will be first and forefront on this issue. And, you know, just this year, back in January of 2011, there was a correctional officer that was actually murdered that worked for the Washington State Reformatory Unit in Monroe, Washington. And there was actually a federal investigation that was done in conjunction with the National Institute of Corrections that actually called on Washington State to review their safety needs and improve their equipment that they actually issued to staff. And they called on officers to have the ability to wear personal body alarms there, which we already carry those, and to issue them pepper spray carry to improve their safety. And the second part of that, which the National Institute of Corrections is involved, and GAO has recommended to the Bureau actually agreed to work with the National Institute of Corrections. So I hope that if they do use the National Institute of Corrections, it is going to approve and recommend our ability to carry this equipment, which we believe is vital to our safety and safety of inmates.
Brian, as you know, there are some intense budget battles here in Washington. How do those budget battles affect the staffing and ultimately the funding levels in the Bureau of Prisons?
Well, Jason, the Bureau of Prisons actually brings in about anywhere from 5,000 to about 7,500 new bed inmate assignments each fiscal year. And with that, with the budget, the reduction in the budgets that the Bureau of Prisons has seen, it has eliminated our ability to construct new prisons to alleviate the overcrowding in some of these situations that we're currently facing. you know, we have to reach out. We have reached out to our legislators, to Congress, to the Attorney General's office, and asked for them to evaluate and to press the need for additional institutions to lower our ability to provide secure and safe supervision of the inmate population. If we don't construct prisons, then we're going to continue to take these inmates' assignments away. Prosecutions of people violating the law have actually increased year to year to year. And the money that has been pumped into the U.S. Attorney's Office for these prosecutions has increased year to year to year. Prosecutions at the highest level, and then you have inmates put in the pipeline to come into our prison system. Now, we're not going to turn any inmates away that are convicted of a crime and have to be housed. But what it forces us to do is to start putting inmates in areas in our prisons that weren't designed to house these inmates, such as common areas, TV rooms, and then start triple bunking inmates where they're assigned cells designed to safely house two inmates in a cell. We are now putting three inmates in a cell.
Brian, I'm curious to know what your status was when we were looking at a potential government shutdown. Were your employees deemed essential?
The majority of our employees were deemed essential. Any employee that worked at an institution that housed inmates, they were going to continue working and we were going to operate our prisons as normal.
So that leads to a larger question. If most of your employees are deemed essential, why is it that year after year you're struggling to get the funding that you need to safely operate the prison system?
You know, that's a million-dollar question, Jason. We, as I stated to you earlier, we have lobbied Congress. We have lobbied the Senate. We have talked to these people. We've talked about our overcrowding. We've talked about the understaffing, the effects that it's having on safety, security. We believe assaults are up based on just overcrowding alone because, as I said earlier as well, it increases tension and stress on these inmates. You know, each housing unit where an inmate is assigned right now only has so many showers, bathroom facilities, TVs available. And as you increase that with the gang activity that we do have and the inmates who are affiliated with gangs and the things that are already going on, it just creates an explosive situation to where sooner or later more serious things are going to continue to escalate and violence will continue to climb. And the worst part of it is we're sending staff in there who are unarmed, who have no ability other than to try to fight inmates off without any additional safety equipment that puts their lives in danger and also puts the inmates' lives in danger.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Brian Lowry about the issues inside the Bureau of Prisons. Brian, what's going on with the assault rates now in the Bureau of Prisons?
Well, Jason, each year assaults have escalated. In this report, it is actually noted that each year assaults have actually increased probably by a number of 100, 150 each year over the last 5 or 6 years. The type of violence that has occurred has escalated. Inmates are younger. They're more gang-oriented or affiliated with gang populations inside of prisons. These inmates manufacture and create weapons out of about any type of material, whether it be plexiglass, wood, any kind of metal that they can get from different areas of the prisons, beds. They're able to cut the metal and then design it. Most inmates manufacture these weapons because our prisons are overcrowded and the tensions are so high. Number one, it's to try to protect themselves since there's less staff supervising these inmates. And then two, when situations do occur where the tension is high, disturbance occurs, or an inmate decides to assault a staff member, in many instances, if they have access to these weapons, then they turn around and use them either on inmates or on our staff.
Brian, the GAO report indicated that about half of the inmate population in the Bureau of Prisons is there because of some sort of drug-related offense. Do you find that there's any correlation between those offenses and the violence that's going on inside the prisons?
I wouldn't actually assess that as maybe 50% of our population is in there for drugs, because in many instances, inmates who receive a higher sentence sometime had other charges either they were convicted for or were pending, and they weren't charged with an end that may have involved guns or some type of violence. Based on each prison and how we calculate the security levels at each prison, then you have more predatory, more violent at the higher security levels.
Are certain facilities more susceptible to violence than others?
I would say your higher security institutions and the ones who actually house more violent type inmates who have been convicted of more gun-related or violent crimes such as murder, rape, and those sort of things are probably, you have more predatory type inmates, so your violence is going to be a little bit higher in those. And those would be United States penitentiaries, which are high security level, and administrative facilities such as metropolitan correctional centers and metropolitan detention centers and federal detention centers.
Do you think there's something that can be done to lower the violence? Is there something that correctional officers can do to keep themselves safer, or is this just the way it is in the Bureau of Prisons?
Well, I think one step that is necessary is that you have to reduce the overcrowding of the population, which would lower the tension and the stress, I believe, and safely house these inmates, and then you would have an adequate amount of staff to be able to supervise. Now, being so overcrowded, adding additional inmates in there, you have more inmates that you have to try to supervise, maintain, and more areas to cover where we're housing inmates.
Brian Lowry, president of AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. As always, Brian, thank you for your time. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll be joined by AFGE contract analyst Tim Shirock on Japan's recovery efforts.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab, or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Tim Shirock, AFGE contract analyst in the Field Services and Education Department. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
You recently penned an article in The Nation about Japan's recovery efforts from the earthquake and subsequent tsunami and nuclear disaster. What's the condition of the country today?
Well, the earthquake was the largest in Japanese history and one of the largest in recorded history, period. So it was a terrible event. And what was the worst impact was from the tsunami that hit the northern part of the coast of the Japan's east coast in the area called Tohoku. And completely swamped, you know, a whole bunch of towns and cities in that area, and hundreds and thousands of people were killed, were drowned with that tsunami, which was just a massive wave that just swept way inland and dragged everything back into the sea. But that had a very devastating effect on a complex of six nuclear reactors, where the waves came and shut down the electricity to the nuclear power plants, causing near meltdown to three or four of the reactors, and that situation is still out of control.
How has the Japanese government responded to the crisis so far?
Well, it's been mixed. I think in terms of the nuclear crisis, the problem from the beginning was lack of clear information about what was really happening, and part of that was the fault of the electrical utility there, which is called Tokyo Electric Power Company, and they're kind of notorious for covering up problems at their nuclear power plants. Japan has a very large nuclear power program, and you know, since the beginning of the program, it's been not really a very transparent program. When these plants were being built in the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of protests, citizen protests, because the hearings, the sort of siting hearings and the procedures for challenging the building of reactors was very undemocratic, and people there felt that, you know, ordinary citizens, workers, labor unions did not have much of a chance to voice their opinions. And after all, this is an earthquake-prone country and a tsunami-prone country, and there was some real dangers that people were trying to call attention to. So the Japanese government, at the beginning was sort of like letting the utility take the lead on what was happening at these plants, but then after a few days it became clear that the utility wasn't really taking responsibility and wasn't being very clear and forthcoming about the real serious problems that were happening there. And so the government took over sort of the publicity part, or the PR part, and explaining to people what was going on. And there's been mixed reviews of that from Japanese populace. I mean, I think this is a new government. Japan was ruled for about 50 years by this very conservative ruling party called the Liberal Democratic Party that was supported by the United States for that whole time. And they finally lost in an election 2 years ago, and a new party called the Democratic Party of Japan came in. And so they don't have that much experience running the country, although the current prime minister, Naoto Kan, has been seen for many years as kind of a reformer, as someone who would willing to take on the bureaucracy there and to push for changes that were more responsive to the Japanese people as opposed to Japanese business.
So do you see this new brand of Japanese government as one that holds companies like TEPCO more accountable for their actions?
Yes, actually, I think to a certain extent that's true. The bureaucracy there is still very powerful. But this current prime minister actually won popularity and became very well known in Japan in the mid-1990s when he was the Minister of Health and Welfare in a coalition government, and he almost single-handedly uncovered a very serious scandal involving tainted blood that was getting into the system in Japan for blood transfusions, and it turned out that there had been a cover-up by the ministry and a refusal by the Ministry of Health and Welfare at the time to allow a new kind of blood that was untainted by HIV and viruses to get in, and they were very slow in doing that, and this prime minister, when he was Minister of Health, uncovered all these documents that showed that the ministry had collaborated with business, with companies that actually provided blood to, let them sell corrupted blood, and, 500 people died as a result. And so when he uncovered this scandal, he became very well known and was seen as someone who could really take on, this kind of corrupt bureaucracy that's existed in Japan for many years.
You indicated that TEPCO has a history of lack of transparency and even cover-ups in some ways. Can you talk a little more about that?
Well, for example, in 2007, 4 years ago, there was a earthquake on the Japan's this would be their west coast, near a very large nuclear complex, and there was a leak of radiation there. There was a serious problem that occurred, not anywhere near like what's going on now, but there was a serious problem that occurred there, and the company, basically at the beginning, you know, covered it up and then, you know, downplayed the radiation spill, release, and it took, you know, the government intervention to find out exactly what had happened. And that was just one example. And, you know, it turned out to be a far more serious incident than they originally said. And to a lesser extent, that kind of thing has happened almost every time there's been like a serious incident in one of their plants. They've sort of either covered it up or tried to minimize what really happened and you know, a lot of obfuscation. And so there's a lot of people that don't really trust this company very much.
And what's the reaction from the public on that?
Well, anger. You know, I think, and actually in the last, you know, Japan is sort of unusual, of course, in terms of nuclear power because they're the only country to suffer from nuclear atomic bombs, atomic attack from the United States. And there's been a, you know, feeling of, you know, people didn't really like nuclear power and for, there was a lot of questions about it for many years. And then, you know, it's sort of like as these plants are built, you know, the economy there, you know, grew and expanded and stabilized and people became less concerned about it. But there was always a sort of nagging fear of, you know, what happens if there's a big earthquake or something. And I think some of those worst fears have been met now, where this particular incident at the Fukushima reactors is now classified as a disaster on the level of Chernobyl in the former Soviet Union. So, you know, we've seen in the last couple of weeks, so pretty large anti-nuclear power demonstrations in different cities, particularly in Tokyo. I think that's something we haven't seen for a long time.
Tim, knowing that nuclear disasters know no borders and the implications of such disasters can be far-reaching around the globe, do you see any pressure from the international community to hold TEPCO and even the Japanese government responsible or to keep them accountable?
Well, I don't know if there's pressure to really keep them accountable so much as try to cooperate with them, and particularly on the government side to deal with it, with the current crisis. I mean, the United States has sent robots, U.S. companies, and you know, with the U.S. government's support, has sent robots in to do these plants to try to get control and try to move stuff around and try to put out the fires. And that's been very helpful. There's been some disagreements between the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the Japanese, equivalent to it, over, you know, the amount of radiation and the actual dangers, you know, from this accident and from what's happened because of the tsunami. And there were some conflicts about that. But I think it's been, you know, there's a lot of cooperation now in trying to resolve this and trying to make sure that this same kind of problem doesn't happen, you know, to plants in other regions of the world. There's, you know, a couple of nuclear power plants in California that are, you know, near earthquake faults and could be hit by tsunami as well. And so I think it's forced sort of, you know, different countries to look at their industry and to see, to review safety. In Germany, they've completely shut down their nuclear reactors. I think a lot of countries are doing that.
You've covered extensively a fascinating subset to this story, which is the people who clean up the mess, who work in these nuclear facilities in Japan. Tell us a little bit about those people.
Well, there's a term for it in Japan. They're called nuclear gypsies, and these are, you know, workers who are subcontracted. They don't actually work for the utility, but they work for, you know, smaller companies that contract their labor to the larger utilities, and they are sent in, you know, to do a lot of the, you know, dirty work in a reactor, which includes, you know, cleaning workers' clothing, you know, cleaning up inside the reactors, cleaning up, you know, spills, small spills, large spills, and they go from plant to plant, which is why they're called gypsies. And often in the past, these workers were recruited from slum areas and from areas of, you know, low income people, basically people who really were desperate for work. And there was a couple of books written about this class of workers back in the 1980s, late 1980s, early 1990s, that really cast a light on their plight. And it turned out that about 90% of the workers in Japanese nuclear reactors were subcontractors. So there's, Japanese industry is kind of known for this, having sort of a class of high, small class of workers at the top who are highly protected, who have good safety conditions and good pay and good benefits, and then, many, many subcontractors that come in from time to time and are called in, during incidents like this to help clean up. A lot of the workers that have been injured at this plant, have been subcontracted workers as well. And, it's a very sad story because some of these workers who have gone in, both, I'm talking about both the full-time and subcontracted, part-time workers, have suffered, injuries. No one really knows quite the extent, but it's very clear that there's been radiation that, and at one point, some of these workers went in with the covering on their boots wasn't very, very efficient and, or sufficient for what was there. And there was all this, radiated water at the bottom on the floor of these plants because they poured all this seawater in to stop the burning. And, received radiation, and I think, the problem with radiation is that, its effects, can't be seen, can't be detected for many years. And so, there may be a series of people may start dying in a few years, from what happened. They're just like what happened in the Soviet Union after Chernobyl.
Tim Shirok, AFGE contract analyst in AFGE's Field Services and Education Department. Tim, thanks so much for your time today. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next we'll be joined by SEIU Healthcare Chair Dr. Tony Lewis on the Affordable Care Act.
Some polls say Americans don't trust government. But listen to our members, the real people who work hard for you every day.
I'm Mike Schnobrick, a correctional officer at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Trust me, the terrorists are locked down tight.
My name is Janet Winghart, a Social Security claims rep in Fort Lauderdale. Senior citizens can trust me to get them the right check at the right time.
I'm Michelle Reed, a registered nurse at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. Trust me, I care for our veterans like family.
My name is Everett Kelly. I work for the Anniston Army Depot, Anniston, Alabama. Trust me, our tanks are tough.
I'm John Gage, president of AFGE. You can trust us. We work for you. Brought to you by AFGE and online at afge.org.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Dr. Tony Lewis of SEIU. Dr. Lewis, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we are at an important time in our nation's history.
Indeed.
We've signed a significant health care bill into law and working to implement that over the next several years. Of course, there has been some opposition to that. What are your thoughts on that? And follow that up with maybe some feedback that you're getting from SEIU members about those efforts to take that away from working families.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's the key right there, working families, and take it away from working families. You know, our members and, you know, labor members, union members, working families for decades have worked for affordable, comprehensive health care for all, so that it's not the thing that breaks your bank, or not the thing that you're scared of, or it's not the kind of the tool of injustice in terms of just you and your body, your health, that you can stay strong. And so the fact that we all work together and work so hard to get it, and now parents can keep children on their insurance up to 26. You don't have to worry about losing your insurance if you have a pre-existing condition or if you get sick. I mean, the fact that those things exist already, when you think about the fact that what a repeal means is taking those things away, literally not being able to cover your children, being worried again about, you know, if you're sick, that doesn't mean you get health care. It's a little bit crazy. It's actually crazy, and it's not just, and it's not what working families need to make their community strong or to make this country strong. We need to be healthy.
Talk about the importance of one's health. Give us a little insight as to what it really means to be healthy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, I have to say, you know, as a family doctor and a geriatrician, I actually do house calls in my clinical life, taking a little break now because this is such an important fight. You know, as a union of healthcare workers, we are looking at that as part of what we're doing over the next couple of years and moving forward, making sure that as a healthcare workers union, we are healthier ourselves. But, you know, I think every one of your listeners and every one of our members in our communities, you know, knows what it's like to be worried about diabetes, asthma, high blood pressure, juggling those medications, how you feel. And, you know, if you live healthy, there's all sorts of kind of mind, body, spirit. There's all these things that really help you function better if you are well and not just focusing on not getting sick. You understand? So it is very important to be healthy, both in mind and in body, just to function and to build and to make the best thing available for your children and generations forward.
The reality is, if yes. you're not healthy, no matter what you want to do in life, it's
Indeed.
Not going to happen.
Right.
So take a minute to give maybe some general tips to some of the listeners out there about what they can do to improve their own health.
You know, so the first thing, you know, as a primary care physician, I'm going to say is that you should talk to your doctor. You know, first of all, just kind of see where you are. I think it makes sense at any age, you know, whether you're, you know, a young adult, an adult in college. I mean, it's actually, you know, one of the reasons it was so important to get this provision up to 26 is that group tends to be uninsured and just kind of rolling the dice at what happens. But why not get in there early and get, you know, a good relationship with a primary care physician just to see kind of where you are in terms of risk factors, in terms of diet, in terms of exercise. And then when you pair up with them, you know, your clinician, whether it's at your community health center, at your clinic, you know, wellness, they can help guide you towards through a good kind of, you know, healthy eating and exercise program to stay active so that you can prevent, you know, chronic diseases and you can live happier on the day-to-day and you can focus on the things that you love to do and on building and on, you know, growing your job and making your family happy versus wondering why you can't breathe or thinking about, you know, the next pack of cigarettes. So start there. And there's a lot of stuff actually on healthcare.gov on that website that helps you with, you know, kind of healthy eating and how to navigate the healthcare system. But yeah, start there. It's simpler and find what works for you, you know.
Obviously, you're part of the labor movement and you understand the importance of labor in our society.
Mm-hmm.
Share a little bit of your experiences with labor being involved with some of the important things that are happening around our country today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It, you know, the importance of labor. You know, actually, so I grew up in a labor household. My mom is a retired teacher, you know, 42 years and was a local union president. My grandma picketed for, you know, teachers' rights and the cold winters of Milwaukee. So, you know, I grew up in a labor household, understanding the importance of having a voice for everyone. And it's really been exciting to me because I actually started with a doctor's union and people that maybe people are probably, you know, raising their eyebrows like listeners right now. Really? Doctors can join a union? But actually, yes, we had 13,000 residents, interns and fellows around the country where I was privileged to serve them. And in talking with our brothers and sisters in labor across the country, like, it doesn't matter what your job is. Doesn't matter where you start, it's all the same in terms of working conditions, having a voice, you know, wanting to make things better, having opportunities. Like, once you get kind of beyond, like, the letters and the titles, it's all the same conversation. We all just want an opportunity to make things better. So the voice of labor is so important. at this time. And as you know, like kind of our density is decreasing a little bit. And so it's not an accident that things for working families are harder. The economy is harder as union density goes down. So we all need to work together to try to make sure we have good jobs for all of us and make sure labor is
How do we bring those membership levels back up and really reach out to people and connect with them and educate them about what the labor movement can do and how it can help them?
Mm-hmm. And I think you nailed it like right there in terms of saying, you know, reaching out to other people and helping them to understand what labor has done in the past and what we can do and what we do so that we're not seen as a special interest. We're not seen as, you know, just any other corporation or big pack. We're seen as a group, or we're seen as members of our community, which is what we are. We're just working people, you know. So I think that kind of hand to hand, that like, you know, member to community, that, you know, we're not just a group of healthcare workers. We're also a group of parents. We're a group of daughters. We're a group of, you know, we are people. And let's just get beyond the labels and start doing that. And I think that will help with membership and to help rebuild the labor movement so we have a strong voice for working families.
Now, as I mentioned earlier and we discussed a little bit, there is some opposition to the law that's now in place, and there have been stated efforts to repeal it. How is SEIU gearing up for that fight?
It's unfortunate that we have to keep what has now been granted just to start there. But as both consumers and providers, you know, the one thing that we really want to do is just keep working to build, just keep working to continue to implement the things that are in the law. So some of it is making sure that we do that. And the other is to make sure that, and getting back to what you said about reaching out to our communities, I mean, we haven't done the best at really educating all of our folks about what's so great about the law. So, that, you know, why do we even have this challenge? So we need to get out there and talk a little bit more to our communities about the great things that already exist and are coming, you know, within the Affordability Care Act. So we're doing that, helping to implement and build our systems, and then just continuing to raise the voices to our legislatures, whatever side they happen to be on, to let them know what we want, what working families need.
Can you share a little bit about what's in the Affordable Care Act that is beneficial to people, mm-hmm. And what they can use going forward?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I think I've already mentioned that, you know, if you're a parent, you can keep, you know, your kids on the insurance till they're 26. You know, for a long time, if you had a pre-existing condition such as, you know, diabetes, hypertension, asthma, you name it, you were concerned that you would not be able to get insurance. So, you know, as of January, you don't have to worry about that. You cannot be denied based on pre-existing conditions. And even before that, we made sure that kids were not denied, because that just doesn't make sense to me, really. You know, and then also a practice that was way too common was that insurance companies were dropping people if they got sick. So if you didn't have a condition, and you all of a sudden got sick, your insurance company could just stop you for no reason. I mean, what's the point of having insurance if they can just decide? So that can no longer happen. Now, and then also for seniors with medications, and this is, you know, one of those things that's near and dear to me, because I remember watching my grandparents struggle with this for years. For seniors with their medications, if they fall into that donut hole, they get discounts on certain drugs that help them. They've also been getting a rebate. So there's a lot of work there just to help them deal with not being able to afford their medications. And then, you know, of course, we're looking at expanding coverage to more than 32 million people, including like 15 million children. So those are some basic things that, like, and if you just think about taking those things away, you can't cover your children. You can be denied coverage. I mean, it doesn't make sense in terms of the repeal effort. So those are basic things, but I would also encourage just going to healthcare.gov to get information for yourself. You can also go to SEIU.org, and we have kind of an Ask the Doctor segment where you can submit your questions and see, you know, other members of SEIU and people who have submitted questions and our answers.
Dr. Tony Lewis of the SEIU, thank you very much for your time. We look forward to having you back on again someday.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you to our guest this week, AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Brian Lowry, Contract Analyst Tim Shirock, and SEIU Healthcare Chair Dr. Tony Lewis. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make a